The errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power at Grantham University. Now here's your host, Jason Forticola.
Today we'll be joined by AFGE U.S. Marshals Service Local 2272 President Jason Wilder, Council of Prison Locals National Fair Practices Coordinator Michael Castell, Families USA Deputy Executive Director Kathleen Stoll, and Senior Health Policy Analyst Kim Bailey. We've been joined by Jason Wilder, President of AFGE's U.S. Marshals Service Local 2272. Jason, welcome back to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. 2011 has been a challenging year for the Marshals Service with budget and staffing deficiencies, along with the unfortunate loss of two deputies in the line of fire. Give us an update. What's happening with your agency?
Well, overall, you can imagine that we're trying to rally as a family nationwide. There are 94 different districts, and so there's a substantial amount of employees throughout the nation. And mostly we're trying to get the family together, so to speak, and rally behind the families of these lost deputies.
Take us through those difficult situations which happened in February and March of this year.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what you mean by take you through it. unfortunately, both incidences were very similar. Each one involved the attempted apprehension of a wanted fugitive. In both circumstances, the fugitives did not go peacefully. Each time the individuals fired upon the law enforcement officers as they attempted to make apprehension, and in both instances, multiple law enforcement officers were shot. And unfortunately, in both instances, our agency lost a deputy under both circumstances.
And this is the first time that you all have lost a deputy since the early 90s, isn't that right?
Yeah, I believe that is true. I think Deputy Frakes was the previous loss to our agency.
And you also had a court security officer who was gunned down in January of last year. Is that correct?
That is correct. That incident took place outside of the Las Vegas courthouse.
And so what do you think the root cause of this is? Is this hostility towards federal employees? Is this something where there are not enough people on the job that should be on the job? What's happening here?
Well, I could certainly say there's never enough employees on the job. Our agency is the oldest federal law enforcement agency in the nation, and we're also one of the smallest agencies in the nation. And given the task that we perform for the United States and the Justice Department, we consistently have to perform those roles and responsibilities with now lesser and lesser employees. Department of Justice has issued a hiring freeze in conjunction with the current budget climate. And so the anticipation is that next year and then probably the next couple of years, we're going to be doing more with less, essentially.
And what's the situation with the budget? How is that impacting you? You know, across the country, we hear a lot about budget cuts and the need to do more with less. How is that impacting you all?
Well, over the last several years, with the creation of the Adam Walsh Act, the United States Marshal Service has become responsible for the sex offenders registry and ensuring that those persons are in compliance with what the law requires them in terms of being registered sex offenders. In addition, we have our typical responsibilities, which is traditional, and that is we service the role of protection of the courts and the judges and federal witnesses. Outside of that, we have fugitive apprehension, which is a pretty considerable undertaking, and as you see, for the loss of our two deputies in the last 2 months, it's probably one of our higher threat situations. We're also responsible for witness security. Witness security can involve many things, but a lot of times it does involve protecting those men and women from the threats that are recognized, and then a lot of times we're protecting them from threats that we don't recognize because they won't make themselves apparent until it's too late in a lot of cases. Outside of that, we do asset forfeiture, which is essentially the disposition of those assets that are seized by the federal government after the commission of crimes. All of these things require a tremendous amount of manpower, and in most most districts throughout the nation, our offices are required to perform these functions consistently because, as you may imagine, most federal judges don't want to hear excuses. They're having to perform those functions with less manpower, and each case often is the case that the employees who are currently working in those offices are required to do more work than they typically would be required to do, and in a lot of times they're required to do work that's actually outside of the nature of their normal position. So you may have administrative staff who are facilitating more than one role. They may have been hired to perform, for instance, timekeeping and other administrative tasks, and now they're suddenly responsible for paying bills in different locations and acquiring space for prisoners in other locations and medical expenses, and the list can go on and on. So, I guess in summary, it's we're doing a lot more with no more personnel, and in some cases a lot less personnel because we lose people through attrition, as does any agency. And right now we're facing an outgoing of people who are of the age that have to retire, which is age 57 for federal law enforcement.
And are you finding that the agency is ramping up its recruitment efforts to bring people on to fill in for those who are leaving?
I would say the agency was. The problem is, like I said, the Department of Justice issued a hiring freeze, which it affected all the plans for bringing in new employees. So we have, with the exception of the Southwest Border Initiative, which we have been given permission to hire for, we have not been able to obtain permission to hire any other positions. So, as I said, we're pretty short-staffed already, and now with the possibility of the next couple of years being even further short-staffed, and then on top of that, you have a freeze in promotions. So you took the incentive away in a lot of cases for a lot of employees to continue to do the same level of work they were doing before. And in our agency, that's a very bad thing. You don't want disgruntled employees who are tired of coming to work every day and who are tired of doing, strenuous activity day in and day out, and then, have to face the possibility that their benefits are going to get cut, who have to face the possibility that their income level is going to be cut. All of these things, any employee, whether you're in the private sector or in the federal sector, we plan for these things. You know, it's natural to keep your eye on the prize being retirement in those after years. Well, when you come to work every day and you're faced with the prospect of dealing with a large populace of the criminal element, your head needs to be in the game. You need to be focused on what the task at hand is. But if you're worried about whether or not your benefits are going to get cut, whether or not your children are going to be able to go to college now, whether or not you are going to be able to retire and live successfully, then your head's not where it needs to be, and that's a problem.
And how does all of this impact the morale of your workers?
It impacts tremendously. Again, the Marshal Service, the journeyman level for the Marshal Service criminal investigator is a GS-12, whereas the journeyman level for the ATF, DEA, and FBI, their criminal investigators go to GS-13. So there was already a morale issue there. Now, faced with the fact that we're going to do more with less, we're probably not going to see those GS-13s that we've been working so hard to obtain. We took on some new tasks over the years in order to make that happen. It impacts morale tremendously, and that's just for the criminal investigator, not to mention the other law enforcement officers, such as your detention enforcement officers or your aviation enforcement officers, who already were stuck pretty much in a GS-7 level or a GS-9 level. Now they're looking at, that being pretty much the inroad because they're not going to be able to promote up while the freeze is going on, and some of these men and women are going to time out and end up retiring before they ever see another pay raise.
And so how do you, as a leader within AFGE, respond to this? We know that you've asked Congress to rescind its budget cuts. What else are you planning to do to sort of rally, as you said, your family of fellow marshals around this?
Well, I think that right now that our strategy is going to push forward with our legislative efforts and continue to ask our people throughout the nation to contact their representatives. Discourage these budget cuts where they impact your more detrimental services, as it were, to the United States. Obviously, I don't want to see anyone's services be cut, and I would never place a value on which federal agency does what. But I can say that your law enforcement agencies certainly should rank high among the agencies that should get priority. And we're just going to rally these people in a grassroots effort to try to get them out there, talking to the representatives, encouraging the representatives to represent them in the way that, you know, is indicative of good service. And aside from that, the best thing that we can do as an agency is to come together, show solidarity, ignore this concept that there's us and them, meaning that there's us who are in the union and them who are not, or us who are law enforcement officers and them who are not. We need to let that go. We need to come together, and we need to make sure that we're all helping one another to get our jobs and our missions accomplished.
And in our last minute here, Jason, is management with you on this? Have they been supportive of your requests to Congress and to get things on the right track?
I could say that management is certainly doing their part as it's allowed and permitted for them to do, because they certainly, you know, want to see additional funding and additional staffing. Whereas management doesn't have a relationship with the union right now that I would say is reflective of partnership or is reflective of making positive changes. Unfortunately, the budget is so tight that management's response to us recently with several issues is that they don't even have money in their budget to negotiate and or bargain. So we're forced to either negotiate by phone or to make issues sit and linger until they can be negotiated at a later time when the money comes in.
Jason Wilder, president of AFGE's U.S. Marshals Service, Local 2272. Jason, as always, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Jason. Take care.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com.
Looking for a new computer, TV, or home appliance? Purchasing Power has a hassle-free way for you to buy these items through easy payroll deduction. You can get the new Dell Inspiron 15-inch laptop for just $30 bi-weekly. Get started today. Log on to shoppurchasingpower.com. That's shoppurchasingpower.com. AFGE members are eligible for a 10% members-only discount for a limited time. Sales tax may apply.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at insidegovernmentradio.com. We've been joined by Michael Castell, AFGE's National Fair Practices Coordinator for the Council of Prison Locals. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission recently released its final report on BOP's EEO program. What did the report find?
Oh, it stated that the staff that participates in the EEO process believe they feel intimidated, they are coerced, they are passed up for promotions, they are blackballed. actually, in all actuality, they say they're being bullied.
In looking at the report here, in the summary, it states that BOP employees perceive a higher retaliation rate than all other federal agencies. Why is that happening within BOP?
Because there's no accountability.
And what did the report find about that lack of accountability?
That's the main reason why employees are being harassed, because there is a grave lack of accountability. The Bureau of Prisons says that the employee reports the allegation to the Office of Internal Affairs, but once it's reported, there's generally no movement because they got a lot of backlog investigations now, and then those investigations goes on the back of those because they have no sense of urgency to them.
And so is this a situation where employees feel like if they report a violation that they'll be punished or somehow treated unfairly?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there is a class action EEO complaint now that just been certified by the EEOC. It's called the Turner class action, and that class action is involving those individuals who participated in the EEO process in the Federal Bureau of Prisons who were denied promotions based on their participation. So this has been going on for years. It's just the EEOC, I applaud them for their investigation, but believe me, this type of retaliation has been going on for years in the Bureau of Prisons, and hopefully now something will be done about it.
And what was the agency's response when the report came out?
Of course they disagreed with it, but they went along with several of the recommendations. But in my opinion, if you keep the same managers and management officials in place that these allegations occurred in the first place, then nothing's going to change because those people who was already in place were accountable for the situation that happened. So what is the agency going to do about their responsibility? That's my question.
Take us through what the report said about the recommendations to fix the problem. Obviously, you think that the management needs to be replaced or you know, a different set of procedures in there. But what did the report say about how to fix the problem?
Well, the report has about 8 different recommendations. They recommended, one, that the agency create an anti-harassment policy. Now, the agency said they'll take on that recommendation. However, because of the backlog and policies between the agency and the union, they couldn't guarantee when this would come out. But that's disingenuous because anytime the parties get together and say they had a policy that's urgent and they needed to get it out, we have always been to the front of the queue. So that was disingenuous within itself. Secondly, there was another recommendation about the Bureau of Prisons and the Affirmative Action Program, which the Affirmative Action Program should be used as a sounding board to identify barriers of discrimination. But that's not how it's being used in the agency. What the Affirmative Action is like a social program. And don't get me wrong, you have to have community outlets, but they do programs like Feeding the Hungry, the Angel Trees, and those are good programs, but that's not the primary function. So that needs to change. And then the Bureau of Prisons policies need to be enforced. Now, the agency is saying they have policies already in place to shore up that EEOC concerns. But if you don't hold nobody accountable for violating those policies, they're not even worth the papers written on.
And what are some ways that you think the agency can be held accountable, that the managers can be held accountable for their actions or violations of EEO policies?
I think if you go through a hearing process and you have a third-party judge, and based on the evidence presented in front of that judge, a person is found guilty of discrimination, then that person also violated the standard of Bureau conduct and the standard of employee conduct in the Bureau of Prisons. That manager should be disciplined. Now, corrective action should be taken. What does it take to make this manager a better manager? That should be what's considered. But it should be some action. To do nothing sends a clear message that discrimination is okay in the workplace. You must do something to correct the behavior of this manager. And if it happened more than once, on that second occasion, you might want to think about either demoting them or terminating them. Because zero tolerance to discrimination, in my opinion, means you don't tolerate it.
Sure. And do you think that if some of those things were corrected, that then employees would have more confidence in the EEO program as a whole?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Just use basic psychology. If you have a child and your child is acting unruly or not following your instruction, but you discipline that child, chances are that child will start following your instruction. It's the same with adults. If you're saying that you have zero tolerance and that this is your livelihood and that you discriminate against somebody, but you're going to be held accountable and it's going to affect your livelihood, yes, you can change. I guarantee that.
And we also noticed in the report one of the recommendations was that the agency should take steps to ensure confidentiality. How big of an issue is confidentiality within the EEO program at BOP?
Well, look at it from this perspective. If I have a complaint, if you're not aware that I'm the one that's dealing with the complaint, you can't retaliate against me. So confidentiality is major. A lot of times a lot of the employees, they don't want to conduct their interviews on site, or they don't want the warden of the facility to know that they have filed a complaint. That's the major issue, because generally when an outside source comes into the institution, the warden is aware of who's coming to the institution. So that's a major issue, and I think they need to be sure. And I think that I'm very willing as the union representative to work with the parties on that. But I have addressed that way before the report came out, and it's hopefully now the agency will have a sense of urgency to change that.
So issues like confidentiality, fear of retaliation, lack of confidence, is that a cultural issue within BOP?
You know, I think the major problem in the Bureau of Prison is the Stockholm Syndrome, as I call it, because all these managers have come up together. They know each other. They overlook the discretions that each other does. It's like the Stockholm Syndrome. And I think what they need to do is to sit back and to evaluate things based on the evidence of it. This is business. It's not personal. Based on the evidence, if the evidence points to this person is discriminating, deal with it in accordance with the evidence. If the agency was to start doing that, it'll function much better.
And as the Fair Practices Coordinator for AFGE's Council of Prison Locals, how are you moving forward with this after seeing the results in the report?
Well, actually, I've made several copies of the report. I've sent it to several different subcommittees in Congress. I actually sent a rebuttal to the report of the agency to the OFO. I've also asked to talk to the Deputy Attorney General, who's over the Bureau of Prisons. I think that's James Cole. But he has not responded to my request as of yet. I'm hoping to get an audience with him, but past practice, it hasn't. I'm not too optimistic about it.
And we know that the EEO issue is part of the master agreement that you all have with BOP, right?
Yes.
And do you think that BOP has lived up to its end of the agreement?
No. Let me give you an experience. And our collective bargaining agreement in Article 22, it talks about using the Affirmative Action Committee meetings as a sounding board to understand the atmosphere for minorities and women in the workplace. I was the local president at the at FCC Petersburg, and I was talking about these type of issues at the Affirmative Action Committee meetings. The warden became very uncomfortable, shut down the meeting, and told me to get up. When I reported it to the agency at the time, they didn't react quick enough, or they didn't react soon enough to send a clear message that the warden's behavior was wrong. It was approximately 3 months later until we came back to schedule another meeting.
How is that acceptable?
It's not acceptable. It's not. But the agency sends mixed messages. The director every year sends out a letter saying he has zero tolerance towards discrimination. But when these allegations are reported to him or his representatives, nothing is being done to enforce his philosophy of zero tolerance.
This report from EEOC, is this really the most movement that you've seen on this issue with the agency?
Yes, it is. I lobbied to the EEOC, because they have open meetings all the time, and I have come to these open meetings for the past several years complaining about the Federal Bureau of Prisons. And I guess I've submitted documentation, and I guess they took me up on it, and I really am appreciative of that. And hopefully, because I do have some scheduled meetings with the agency now in regards to this report, so we'll see where we go from here.
I want to move back to this retaliation piece for a minute. Do you find that within the Bureau that retaliation is a larger problem than just with EEO cases?
Oh, yes. I think anytime you participate in union activity, protected activities or EEO protected activities, you are retaliated against. It's for better, for lack of a better terminology, the Bureau of Prisons is a great, big old, good old boy organization. And if you're not a part of that system, you are labeled a troublemaker. You got to go along to get along. It's a major problem.
And so what does the union do in those instances to protect the worker or to make the worker feel more comfortable in the workplace and not be so fearful of retaliation for doing something like reporting an EEO violation or participating in a union-sponsored activity?
First of all, we make sure that the ACA is aware that this employee has been retaliated against. We also we lobby Congress all the time in regards to these type of actions going on in the Bureau of Prisons. And if the last resort, we will always follow an administrative remedy to protect the employee's rights to participate in those particular activities.
And as we're coming down in here to our last minute, Mike, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, you know what? It's like this. If you believe in something, stand behind it. Don't put words on paper you don't believe in. I challenge the director of the Bureau of Prisons to do what he says he's going to do. Zero tolerance means you have no tolerance toward discrimination. Don't make it a paper issue. Stand behind what you believe. And that will be my last word.
Michael Castell, National Fair Practices Coordinator for AFGE's Council of Prison Locals. As always, Michael, thank you for your time and your expertise.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Kathleen Stoll, the Deputy Executive Director of Families USA. Welcome to the program.
I'm glad to see you're here with us today.
We're having a great time here at the Health Action 2011 conference. Tell us a little bit about what's happening so far.
Well, let me tell you a little story if I can. Each year we bring about 600 to 700 state advocates who work on health care from across the country into Washington, D.C. And last year, let me paint you a picture. We had folks come into town right after the Massachusetts election, and we really didn't know what to think, and were we going to be able to achieve the victory of passing the Affordable Care Act. This year, we have 700 folks in town, and we're celebrating the accomplishment of passing the Affordable Care Act. And of course, folks are a little fatigued. It's been a long fight, but they're taking a deep breath and thinking about what we have to accomplish in this coming year as we go forward.
Talk a little bit about the inner workings of the Affordable Care Act. What's in it? Who benefits from it? And sort of what went involved to get it passed?
Well, the Affordable Care Act really has a couple key things to keep in mind. One, it ensures that insurers play fair. It has a broad range of consumer protections so that people have pre-existing conditions, can purchase coverage, and they don't have to pay sky-high premiums. We've seen people without the Affordable Care Act who have, you know, a minor pre-existing condition see their premiums go up to $30,000 or $40,000 a year. So it has a range. It keeps insurance companies from finding that you didn't dot an I or cross a T in an application. And so when you do get sick, they say, yep, sorry, no coverage for you, even though you've paid premiums. There's a range of consumer protections. It then creates a new marketplace where people can go to purchase insurance where they'll get more value for their premium dollar. They're called the exchanges. There'll be one in every state. And the states really have a lot of flexibility to design these exchanges, but they do have to play within certain rules to make sure that consumers get good value for the dollar. Another part of the Affordable Care Act is help with the cost of coverage. And there's two kinds of help. One is really what I would call robust premium subsidies for middle-class families so that they don't have to pay the full freight of premiums on their own, so they actually are protected from spending no more than a small portion of their family income on health insurance. The other picture of the affordability painting is that there are a range of demonstrations, pilots, and programs that will help bend the cost curve so that premiums won't continue to go up 6, 8, 10, 12, even 14% a year. And until we bend that cost curve, everything else we do is going to be facing the problem of the underlying rapid rise in healthcare costs. So the Affordable Care Act touches all of those.
Yeah, you hit on a key point, and that's trying to keep the increase in premiums down. 14% on anyone, you know, working American, is too much to ask.
And you have to remember that depending on your situation, if you have coverage through an employer, you may be protected a bit from high premium increases, but not necessarily. We've seen small businesses in the Washington, D.C. area face 20% plus premium increases in just 1 year. And folks in D.C. government know what I'm talking about. They're facing those kinds of increases, too, and trying to keep their folks, the workers there, covered.
As do federal employees who continue to face premium increases in their health care plan every single year. We hear about this every year. It continues to increase.
The federal employees health benefits plan does help secure better value for your premium dollar, but the real problem, too, that the Affordable Care Act has to address and will, and I think does in many strong ways, is get at underlying health care costs and how we pay for health care. I mean, right now there are lots of incentives in our health care system to pay for everything that you could possibly imagine. So every doctor wants to order every test. You may get your blood drawn three times in one day if you see three, your primary care doctor and two specialists. We need to change that so that we're paying for outcomes and quality and not just for the quantity of times your finger gets pricked. So there's Jonathan Gruber spoke this morning at our conference, an economist out of MIT, and he's pointed out that every good plan or idea or initiative that will help bend the underlying health care costs and therefore lower premiums, those ideas, plans, initiatives are represented in the Affordable Care Act as demonstrations, pilots, or newly funded programs.
Let's talk a little bit about the pre-existing conditions piece of that. I think that might be one of the, if not the most important parts of this new act, in no longer being able to deny someone because of a pre-existing condition.
Well, it's it's an issue, first of all, that we know the public has embraced. And one of the reasons why we see polling in focus group research showing the popularity of the protections for people with pre-existing health conditions is that we know that about 129 million people in this country have some sort of pre-ex. And Families USA looked at the more serious pre-existing conditions that are very likely to lead to denial of care. You cannot buy insurance at any price. That's about 57 million Americans. So that means those folks are really, if they lose their employer-based coverage, they're locked out of the health care security of being able to purchase coverage. That's why it's real important. The Affordable Care Act says if you have a pre-existing condition, you're guaranteed the right to purchase coverage, and you won't be charged any more than someone that's healthy. And that's the essence of health insurance.
You would hate to be in a situation where you're sick and the only option available to you is to get sicker.
That's right. And, you know, you have to play that ripple effect through the healthcare system. If people with pre-existing conditions can't buy insurance, they can't access healthcare. There is no guarantee of care in this country without health insurance. You might get stabilized at a hospital, but you're not going to get any long-term treatment. When people forego treatment, they get sicker and sicker, and then when they finally get to a crisis, they enter the healthcare system, and they cost us much, much more. And that means all of us pay more for our health care, and insurance companies pay more for our health care, so our premiums go up.
Kathleen Stoll, the Deputy Executive Director of Families USA, here talking about health care, the Affordable Care Act. Take us through what you've seen so far from the Health Action 2011 conference.
Well, this morning we had an exciting morning. We heard from Senator Harkin, Senator Baucus, Representative Becerra, and my hero, one of my heroes, Nancy Pelosi, from Representative Nancy Pelosi, former Speaker of the House, really one of the champions of health care reform, came and spoke to us. And then we heard from Jonathan Gruber. Jonathan Gruber is an economist out of MIT, and what he did was present the facts. And he kept reminding the audience that everything I'm telling you, I have books of evidence to show that these are the facts. This is the real story behind the Affordable Care Act. One of the interesting facts that he shared was that the reduction in the cost of health insurance in Massachusetts and their equivalent of an exchange or connector has been about 50%, so pretty significant. And he also reminded us that it was a Republican, Mitt Romney, who supported, passed, and applauded the connector, which is the same as an exchange, and the irony now that he has decided that it's good enough for Massachusetts but not good enough for the rest of the country.
So for the attendees here today, what lies ahead for them? What's the task at hand that they need to embrace going forward?
Well, the advocates across the country at the state level are going to be pivotal as we move forward in two ways. One, they have to do the nuts and bolts work on implementation, making sure that the state exchanges, the new marketplace for the purchase of insurance coverage, works well and works for their state. That's a big task, making sure that enrollment works well for people, and that'll be the face of reform across the country. At the same time, those same folks are going to be working hard and working with us here at Families USA to educate the public about the real concrete benefits that are in the Affordable Care Act. And one of the things that I think is most important in telling the story of the Affordable Care Act is to use real people. And there are plenty of real people out there who have seen real concrete benefits. Our state advocates help us find those people, bring them forward, share them with the media. And that really, that's what tells the story. The facts and figures that Jonathan has that I try to develop for families really don't have the emotional impact of those real stories.
Now, while attendees here today and people like yourself are working on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act and moving it forward, there are some in the House of Representatives who want to repeal it, take it away, be done with it. Comment on that a little bit.
Well, we had a vote in the House of Representatives, H.R. 2. It was a vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act. It passed. We knew it would. It will go nowhere in the Senate. And, of course, even if it could go somewhere in the Senate, we've been reassured it doesn't. It won't. The president would veto it. So the repeal, the full repeal threat, isn't a real threat. It's all about messaging. And the way I look at it is that it is a wonderful opportunity on a silver platter to keep the Affordable Care Act in the news so that we can continue to educate folks about the real concrete benefits. So bring it on, because every time the opponents of health reform say repeal it, we can ask, repeal those protections for people with pre-existing conditions so they can purchase insurance, repeal the new Medicare benefits that allow seniors to get a free well checkup and preventive services for free. Do you want to repeal the fact that young adults can now go on their parents' plans up to the age of 26? It's very important to many families. We can just respond with repeal what? Repeal the small business tax credits that help small businesses offer coverage to their workers. And they don't have a good answer to those questions.
You mentioned that small business tax credit. That's about 30 or 35%, isn't it? I mean, that's pretty significant.
That's right. That's right. First of all, about 4 million businesses across the country are eligible for it. That's a lot of small businesses with a lot of representing a lot of workers. The maximum tax credit is 35% of the cost of providing coverage to their workers. It is a sliding scale. But it's really making a difference. The take-up rates of small businesses who are taking advantage of this new small business tax credit are much higher than anyone predicted. If you're a small businessman and you're struggling to offer coverage to your workers and you're thinking about whether you can continue to do so in the future, this small business tax credit tips you over to the side of continuing to offer coverage.
Now, as we close out here with our last minute, I'm going to give you the last word.
Well, what I want to say that's on my mind is seeing 700 folks from across the country here today who fought so hard for the passage of the Affordable Care Act and are all taking a deep breath and ready to keep fighting to explain to the public what's in it, fight those who would repeal it. It's pretty inspiring. It makes me realize that this is not a small team out there that understands what the Affordable Care Act will do to help American families and that they're ready to continue to educate and fight for the bill.
We certainly appreciate your efforts, and we'll keep an eye on this, obviously, in the years ahead. Kathleen Stoll, Deputy Executive Director of Families USA, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
We're going to pause here for a short break. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com.
Attention AFGE members. AFGE has formed an exclusive partnership with Grantham University to offer you and your family members a special discounted tuition rate. With Grantham University's 100% online degree programs, it's even easier to earn a college degree while working full-time and meeting the needs of your family. Military and government training may be eligible for transfer credit. Find out more at grantham.edu/AFGE. That's grantham.edu/AFGE.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Kim Bailey, Senior Health Policy Analyst with Families USA. Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Jason.
So we are here today at Families USA's Health Action 2011 conference. Tell us what you've been doing so far. What have you seen?
We have seen a lot of state advocates coming together to talk about the Affordable Care Act and how we can implement it to make quality, affordable coverage available to all Americans.
So tell us about that Affordable Care Act. That is obviously a hot topic. Tell me about what's in it. who it benefits, who likes it, who doesn't.
Every single American has the potential to benefit. There's a whole gamut of things in it. There's affordability protections to make coverage higher quality. There's opportunities to purchase coverage if you're a small business person going out on your own, because we're going to eliminate pre-existing condition exclusions and make coverage available to all regardless of your work status. There's things to invest in prevention and in primary care. There's improvements to Medicare. There's a whole range of things within the Affordable Care Act.
I've heard a little bit about that prevention piece, and that the Affordable Care Act really does try to focus a lot on preventing illness, getting people healthy. Can you talk a little bit about some of the things that are in the Act that people can take advantage of that will help them prevent disease?
Absolutely. The first thing I'd say is that starting this year, all new health insurance plans have no cost for recommended preventive health care services. That's a huge thing for people. No more cost sharing for those services.
What is that? Is that like a physical? Is that going to the gym? Is that getting a massage? What is that?
That means going to the doctor to get things like a colonoscopy, a mammogram, your cholesterol checked, blood pressure checks, all of those sorts of things. It's also well baby visits, immunizations for your children. All of those things will now be covered free of charge.
Yeah, and some of those things are really the very foundation to preventing, obviously, an illness. And, you know, if you get your blood pressure checked regularly and you're okay, then you know that you're not at risk for something beyond that. But if you don't, and you don't know that you have high blood pressure, then all of a sudden you're in a pretty bad situation if something goes wrong.
Absolutely. And if you look at something like cancer, we want to get people screened so that we diagnose cancer in early stages. It's not only problematic for an individual, but it's problematic for our system when people get diagnosed in later stages.
So tell us about what it's like being a health policy analyst. What goes into your day-to-day responsibilities with families?
Well, my day-to-day responsibilities involve a lot of quantifying the problem, or at least that's what I've done historically. We at Families USA advocate for quality, affordable coverage for all Americans. And in my capacity there, I've spent a lot of time looking at the number of uninsured Americans, looking at the quality of coverage that American families have, and things like how many people are underinsured, how many people don't have coverage that protects them from health care costs that are catastrophic, and looking at the benefits packages that people are offered.
What have you found with some of those benefits packages? I know a lot of people just figure they'll get a job that's got, you know, a benefits plan and they'll be okay, but that may not be the case for everybody, right?
Well, I think what we've seen over the last 20 years, look at the last decade, since 2000, premiums have increased astronomically. And it puts employers in a really, really tough position. And they're forced to make difficult decisions about whether they're going to offer a raise to their employees or whether they're going to try to do something to their health benefits package to help hold premium costs down. And what we've seen over the last number of years is that there's been a steady erosion in the quality of health coverage that is offered to Americans. And that means that we're all paying more out of pocket for the care that we have.
So as you're going around the conference here today and you're talking to people, what are you hearing? What are people saying? I mean, I imagine the crowd's probably pretty fired up about what they're seeing right now.
I think there's a number of things that people are talking about. The first thing on a sort of wonky level is how are we going to make this law work for people? What are we going to do to implement the exchanges, make them function well, get people enrolled in coverage, get people the quality coverage that they need, and help to bring their healthcare costs down? The other thing that we're hearing is how do we talk about this bill? How do we get people to understand what's actually in the law? And that is a really key point for all of us, especially, you know, in my capacity of Families USA, we advocate from inside the belt way. And we're really trying to work with state advocates to talk about what's in the law and how it will help the people in their states once they're back home.
I think that's a very, very interesting point because, you know, the reaction by the American people as a whole is mixed. It's varied. Some people really like it. Some people don't like it at all. Some people are lukewarm on it, or maybe they don't know much about it. But if you start to break down the individual points of it, the things that are in it that can benefit them, then the response is much more favorable, right?
Absolutely. When you look at things like eliminating pre-existing condition exclusions, when you look at things like providing out-of-pocket caps to protect people from catastrophic costs, everyone likes those things. I think there's a real fear of change, and I think that's really fundamentally what some of the mixed numbers comes down to. When you break apart the law and really explain the nuts and bolts, people like it. And that's going to be our job moving forward, is making sure that people know how it's going to benefit them.
So that educating piece, how do you go about doing that? Are there resources that people can
find on Families USA, maybe the website or something like that, where they can learn more?
If folks go to www.familiesusa.org, we have a number of resources. We also work with a network of state advocates to help them develop resources that work in their state specifically.
So how does that work? So you partner with other organizations to maybe do things throughout the country?
That's right. We partner with other organizations at the state-based level. We also work to bring states together so that they can start discussing what works in Iowa and how that might help people in Oregon, and discussing the best practices across states. There are, you know, of course, a wide diversity of demographics and other factors that influence what will work in one state and not in another. But having folks have an opportunity to get together to discuss those things and really build on the successes in a given state is crucial.
So while families and all the attendees here today are trying to move this thing forward to make sure it gets implemented properly, there are some other people that are trying to repeal it. Why is that happening in the first place, do you think?
Well, I think my thoughts on that are that we need to do a job effectively at educating people. That's really why we're all here. We want to get people to understand what's in the law and how it's going to help people. If we can do that well, there will be a groundswell of support for it, and we will get it implemented and make it work. So that's really our role moving forward, is to get education materials out there, do technical assistance with the states, have people in the states talk to their neighbors and friends. That's the best thing that we can all do as Americans, is actually do that grassroots organizing within our own communities. And that can happen on a really casual level.
So maybe when someone says, well, we should repeal that law, if enough people out there have been educated and understand the points of it and know what goes into it, they could probably fight back and say, no, we don't want to, you know, that's not what we want. That's not what we're interested in. We want this thing to move forward, not to go backwards, right?
Exactly. And the other thing I think we really need to start talking about is our system needs change. You know, if we don't do anything, we're going to be going in a direction that's completely unsustainable. So we need to do something to bring healthcare costs under control and ensure that people are getting access to care.
So we're coming into our last minute here. I'm going to turn it over to you with any final thoughts that you might have.
Well, I would just say that, you know, the best thing that people can think about is how this law will help them. There's a lot in the Affordable Care Act. There's real opportunities to make coverage quality, affordable, and really accessible to all people.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE U.S. Marshals Service Local 2272 President Jason Wilder, Council of Prison Locals National Fair Practices Coordinator Michael Castell, Families USA Deputy Executive Director Kathleen Stoll, and Senior Health Policy Analyst Kim Bailey. And that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power and Grantham University. Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab, or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Some polls say Americans don't trust government, but listen to our members, the real people who work hard for you every day.
I'm Mike Schnobrick, a correctional officer at the Supermax in Florence, Colorado. Trust me, the terrorists are locked down tight.
My name is Janet Winghart, a Social Security claims rep in Fort Lauderdale. Senior citizens can trust me to get them the right check at the right time.
I'm Michelle Reed, a registered nurse at the Minneapolis VA Medical Center. Trust me, I care for our veterans like family.
My name is Everett Kelly. I work for the Anniston Army Depot, Anniston, Alabama. Trust me, our tanks are tough.
I'm John Gage, president of AFGE. You can trust us. We work for you. Brought to you by AFGE and online at afge.org.